secret report from the guild. The boat has the spice. The spice must flow. You must listen to the Mullet Guild.
Welcome to the Mullet Guild, a special look at Dune from Phantom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet. Find all about the Dune universe here on this podcast. This podcast is for people that have never read Dune and are going into the movie in December 18 this year. Find out all about the world, the planet Arrakis, the different schools, the Swordmasters, the Mentats, the Bene Gesserit, and of course the Navigators. Find out about the medical Sook doctors. Find out about the Atreides, House Carino, and House Harkonnen, all here on Phantom Podcast Network's The Mullet Guild, hosted by the Lethal Mullet. Hey guys, welcome to the show. Welcome to The Mullet Guild live here on Phantom Podcast Network. Here we're going to be chatting Dune today again. Of course, this is the third episode, and of course we are going to be giving you, particularly the new reader, the new listener, an idea about the Dune universe. We're going to basically take it down to its essentials, what it is. And joining me today, all the way over from the United States of America, is one of the greatest when it comes to Dune. He loves Dune games, particularly tabletop, which we're going to get into today as well. The one, the only, the host, of course, of What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, the only, Scott Bowman. Mate, how are you?
I'm doing great, Adam. I am honored to be here and very excited to talk a little Dune. You know, the other two guys on our podcast about Star Wars, Derek Marsh and Nathan Miracle, they're great when it comes to Star Wars. They're awesome when it comes to Star Trek, but they are not spice heads like you and I are. I think sometimes they're a little young to be as enamored of that desert planet Arrakis as we are, because, you know, prior to Lynch's movie in the 1980s, it was mostly a sci-fi novel phenomenon, and phenomenon is definitely the right word. And so those guys are a little young to have caught on to that kind of wave of sci-fi literature that we had in the 1960s and 1970s that has still, to this day, influenced so much of modern pop culture. So it's great to be here on the Mullet Guild, although I guess I have to be honorary member of the Mullet Guild because I don't have enough hair left these days to grow a mullet.
Look, I tell you what, when it comes down to mullets, it's all in the spirit, I tell you.
Yes, I have a mullet attitude, so I'm definitely about business in the front and party
in the back.
But,
yeah.
But I don't have the physical mullet, so.
Nice. Now, obviously, as you say, yeah, like it really was for a lot of years, just the novels, and particularly right through to the 70s, it was a trilogy. So we had, of course, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune. And I mean, that's pretty much what he wanted to write at the time. Of course, we're talking about Frank Herbert when he released it in 1965. He already had the plan for three books. He already had that out there. But obviously, it's grown beyond that. We obviously got the real pivotal point, which is, of course, God Emperor, which opens up the next trilogy. Kind of a bridging work. And, you know, I've got to say, God Emperor for me is a bit of a life-changing novel. Just some of the stuff that Leto, you know, he doesn't do a lot. In the novel itself, it's all about philosophies and stuff like that, ways of life and how to get humanity forward. It's a different kind of work, that one, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we're making a big deal about the upcoming film and how excellent actor, you know, Oscar Isaac is noted, slated to play Duplito. And like you said, he's actually not as important in the books as one would be led to believe by having such a marquee actor cast to play that character. I think it was an interesting choice of Frank Herbert to do that in the original trilogy of novels. So it's nice to see that he took the time to go back and fill in some.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, one of the great things, too, is that obviously we both come from a time where, you know, it got celebrated by a David Lynch movie. We're at one stage going to have a Jodorowsky film, which would have been very, very interesting. If you've seen the documentary out there, guys, you'll know what I mean, don't you?
Interesting is a charitable way to describe what Yudorovsky had planned. I would have more said it was. So it's interesting because you definitely can see that the idea of psychedelic drugs may have been broached in Yudorovsky's interpretation. But then again, to be fair to anyone who was analyzing Dune prior to the 1980s, the spice itself and the way it is treated in that society in the novel, in that world of Dune, is almost like a psychedelic drug, you know. Mm. And a guy who had lived the life of Frank Herbert, it wouldn't surprise me at all that that was what he wrote about in his magnum opus, as it were.
You know, you're 100% right. And the thing is, like, particularly if you look at some of the castings that he was doing, that and the bringing in David Carradine to play Leto and Mick Jagger to play Fade. All the, you know, there's a real rock and roll punk vibe to it. And he's going to have Space Pirates with Chris Foss doing all the artwork for it. And, yeah, you know, I remember, probably, I'm sure you remember too, Chris Foss pretty much donned the covers of every single science fiction novel we read from the 70s to the mid-80s. You know, like he was always there. Brilliant covers, eh?
Oh, beautiful art. And the fact that they were thinking about having Mick Jagger play Fade, that is testament to the fact that, as you and I both know, Hollywood never throws anything away. They mm-hmm. always keep stuff around until they can remake it or at least reuse it. And so you can tell that idea that Yudorovsky had about getting a pop star to play Fade kept on through Lynch's idea, because who'd we get as Fade? Well, of course, it was Sting. The poor man's Mick Jagger, if you will.
100% right. And what's it really is. Like, I mean, and still has that punk vibe because he came from the Police, you know, which was kind of reggae punk. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is, too, we both come up in time when that movie hit, and it really, I mean, it is what it is. It's a David Lynch movie. There's no mistake about that. And, you know, the vibe, the feel, the merchandise that came out. I even remember the Dune ads on TV out here, which they launched a few for a local place out here, Toy World, which it's been around for 40, 50 years, whatever it is. And you had the Spice Crawler, you had the Space Worm, they called it, which, of course, was a sandworm. And, of course, you had the little Battle-matic action figures from LJN, where they had the little arms going up and down, and, you know, they all had some type of chopping action, pretty much, like a lot of those action figures back then. Do you remember the merch?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Did y'all get any of the Ornithopter toy down there?
No, unfortunately not. We did get all the ones that were like sand-based, so the little Dune buggy, basically, sort of stuff, but one thing we did get, the Fremen Tarpnel gun. And I do remember one of our neighbours when I was living in Brisbane had it. And we couldn't make head or tails about what it was because he was a Star Wars fan as well. And he said, I'm pretty sure this is a lightsaber handle. I said, well, why does it have a trigger? Like,
yep. Now, I had a toy as a kid, and I think this was probably around 84 that I got this, because, you know, back then, toys for movies would hang around in stores sometimes forever.
Yeah.
And my parents were keen on getting me stuff from, like, a discount bin, you know. Mm-hmm. So I got a Chris knife that you could push the button and the blade would pop out, you know. Which probably wasn't really all that screen authentic, but it was definitely reminiscent of the idea of having the hidden blade, you know, a big thing in Doom.
Oh, it really was. But for me, back in 84, I was in full Robotech mode, whatever else was out, Masters of the Universe. So Dune, mm-hmm. I saw it, I realised it was there, but it passed me at that time. And it wasn't until about, I think it was, must have been about 89 or 1990, where they were releasing a lot of bigger versions of movies. And this would have been the Alan Smithy cut of the film, which not only came out on TV, and they split it up into two nights. So a little bit, I suppose, what Denis Villeneuve's doing now with splitting up the book into two parts. And it was a mini-series style.
Which is a wise move. That is a good idea. I was so relieved to hear that Villeneuve was going to make two films, and even more relieved to hear that the two films have already been, you know, greenlit.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, that and plus the TV series, which we'll talk about soon as well, you know, they're definitely aiming to have this be not just a little, you know, crammed in storytelling, like obviously the Lynch movie was. But what great about it, I remember watching it on a Saturday night, the first part came out, and I went, okay, wow, okay, it's not Star Wars, you know, and I was expecting it to, because it looked like Blade Runner, and I enjoyed Blade Runner's look, and it had that sort of gothic, broken down, technology's so worn and old sort of look to it, but it's sort of medieval at the same time. There's this real Baroque feel to whatever this universe was that Lynch had created. And, you know, I did see the Bene Gesserit as Jedi, which is really weird because, I mean, that's all I knew of that at that stage. There was this weird organization of women who were trying to find the Chosen One, basically. And
And when we look at the way that the Jedi behave in the prequel trilogy, it definitely looks a similar idea. It's a group, a quasi-religious group that's trying to find the Chosen One. Or in the case of the Bene Gesserit, in many ways, trying to bring about the Chosen One.
That's right. So, but I think the biggest thing is after watching those two, I went out to a local video store and I got that long 3+ hour cut or whatever it was and sat down and watched it. Still didn't know what I was watching. So I went, all right, I've got to read the book.
Right. Yeah.
And I did it. I finally did it and I went, oh, hey, this is actually pretty good. That I will say this, and I'll admit this on air, and I kind of chatted about it in the last episode, but I'll admit that I read it waiting to see weeding modules, and guess what? No, none are in the book.
Yep, not a thing. Yeah. I've often wondered, and, you know, there have been various behind the scenes, talks about why did Lynch decide to include the module instead of just having people do the voice, you know?
100%. Yeah.
And I've never really found a very satisfactory explanation as to why they did that, other than they felt that the audience would just, you know, coming off of Star Wars and Star Trek, the audience would not be as accepting of just straight up psychic or telepathic, almost magical powers. They wanted some kind of real world technological explanation for it. And I think Dune suffered a bit, certainly in many ways in Lynch's film, but the whole atmosphere suffered a bit when you remove that mystical quasi-religious element, you know.
Now, I don't know if you can see this book, but I've got the original Dino De Laurentiis making of right here, and that's the old paperback. Yeah. So in this one, I went through, I was flicking through like the designs, and they've got all the ships and stuff in there, and they've got the Tartanal gun, believe it or not. So they've got some of that stuff in there. They've got the guild ships and stuff. But what they don't have, of course, if very suspiciously hidden there, is, of course, the weirding modules. And so anyway, when I was looking through that stuff, I went, what is it about the weirding modules? First of all, I just like it because it's a cool ray gun that makes sonic beams, you know, like that's, you know, it's definitely not the weirding way, you know, which is a completely different thing. But then I went, okay, well, what's Lynch really doing? He's trying to visually convey something very, very quickly. And I mentioned this in the last episode, guys, so check that out if you haven't seen episode 2 yet. But this is just simply a visual metaphor to get across the voice and how to train in the voice quickly so people see it. But the problem is he doesn't do that. He actually spends more time with it than he needs to. You know, and
he has Paul and the other Fremen guys demonstrate to us how the thing works, and we get a classic 1980s training montage with the wording module, and then we have that almost as a gigantic laborious setup for the fact that Muad'Dib's name is a killing word in the voice, and I think it would have been so much cooler if we kept it as telepathic, you know, completely in your mind stuff, then Muad'Dib's name would be a killing word that way, you know, so.
And I'm sure Denny will probably do something more along those lines. He's definitely had some very expert, put it this way, fight consultants on it. So we're definitely going to have to see Bene Gesserit use their hands a little as well, as in, you know, that we'll see some combat that way. Because at the end of the day, he is a male Bene Gesserit. That's what the Kwisatz Haderach is to look there where the women cannot, which is, of course, down the male line of that timeline, you know, to forward or back using their power. But, yeah, so I think at the end of the day, weeding module was always just a visual metaphor to get across the voice somehow, but it just was not handled well. At the end of the day, you can definitely do it. training through the voice, doing it as, I think it was perfect when they're doing the box at the start, when he puts his hand in the box, that whole thing, that was more than enough, don't you think?
You had easily a setup for psychic powers from the Bene Gesserit. You could have, because we, as the audience, we thought that Paul's hand was on fire, you know?
Yeah.
And it was withering away to nothingness. But then when he pulled it out, everything was fine because it was all in his mind. He even talks about it in his inner monologue, which that's another thing we should probably discuss about Lynch's version of the story. His inner monologue, so much about, you know, fear is the mind killer. So he emphasizes the fact that this is all mental, you know, and in this case, telepathic from the Bene Gesserit there. I don't know why you would have the scene with the box at the beginning of the film and not just follow it on through when it came time to talk about the voice. Why would you need to introduce technology when you had clearly set us up to understand that, that in this universe, much like in Star Trek, when Spock does a mind meld, there are telepathic powers and people can connect, communicate directly from one mind to another. And sometimes over vast distances, they can communicate from one mind to another. I don't know why. I guess he just got cold feet.
It could be that. I mean, there's also the fact that we're at a time where every single sci-fi franchise had something cool. Star Wars had lightsabers. Star Trek had phasers, you know, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe they were looking along the lines, we need something cool. But there's multiple different things in this thing that will obviously be that way. But first of all, let's have a quick chat about where you first experienced Dune and what put you on the path to the golden path of Dune, mate.
Yeah, so the biggest thing was, you know, early 80s, I was very young, but a huge Star Wars fan, of course. And so as a result of that Star Wars fandom, I wanted to check out almost anything that had to do with spaceships and StarCraft and all that stuff. So I was devouring Flash Gordon, Defenders of the Earth. Yeah, buddy, we gotta have an episode about that
someday. Oh, yes.
Defenders of the Earth. And then, of course, Star Trek got to be on my radar. Mm-hmm. And then, like you had mentioned, they took the David Lynch Dune film and they broke it up into two nights worth of a TV movie, almost a miniseries, if you will.
Oh, wow.
And so when that came on American television, it started on a Sunday night and went through part Monday and part Tuesday. And so I watched it that I want to say that was a summer event, but maybe not. Anyway, the first time I saw Dune was in that television miniseries almost of them breaking up the Lynch film. And it was fascinating. It was just amazing to me. I remember being not scared of Baron Harkonnen as much as I was just grossed out by him. But I loved the idea that it took to my little kid brain. What happened was Paul drank a magic potion in the desert and he became like Superman, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is in one respect, a perfectly valid interpretation of Dune. Spoiler alert. Paul becomes awesome. Anyway. You know, and I was just at the right age to start noticing that, you know, girls might not be filled with cooties. So it was great to see powerful women who, you know, were more than just trying to be babelicious. They used their internal power and their if you will, left-handed power to affect the course of human history without being overtly in charge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a nuanced world. And even as a young boy, I noticed how different it was than, say, Star Trek or Star Wars. So much more sophistication and layers upon layers. You know, that desert is very deep on Arrakis.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. Now, obviously, we've talked about our first times and, well, I've got to say it because I've just had a message late last night from our dear co-founder, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel, who, you know, he knows of Dune through the movie and the sci-fi miniseries, but he's tried it, never could quite get into it. He said it's a bit of a roadblock for him. But he said, I'm going to give it a go, but he said, I'm going to have a listen to your podcast. And so he had to listen to the first episode. He said, you know what, that's got me charged up. He said, it's just enough info for me to actually might find this actually cool. So he's going to give the Lynch movie a go and the miniseries as well. I said, well, definitely do the miniseries. I said, you know, I think at the end of the day, the Lynch one is just, you know, it is what it is. But I think if he gets the sci-fi miniseries, just it gets at least the core of what the first book is down pat.
Yes, yeah. And one thing that I've heard people talk about with regard to sci-fi's miniseries is that looking back at it now, it doesn't always hold up so much because sometimes it just feels like they're at a high school play standing in front of a backdrop. You know?
Yes.
And on the one hand, that is true, and it can for modern audiences. It can detract from it. But on the other hand, when you think about the fact that the important parts of Dune are the character drama and the philosophical underpinnings and the statements about humanity, regardless of at which point in our history it will be, either the medieval past or the far-flung future, that means that it is uniquely suited almost to be a stage play.
I can
definitely see there being a theater adaptation of Dune that, you know, focuses so much on the themes and the characters and doesn't care too much about the special effects.
I think you've nailed it. Like there's a very Shakespearean aspect to, I think, particularly the first book, because it's more dialogue heavy than it is exposition. Because a lot of what we learn about things comes out in those dialogues. I mean, a perfect example is the first scene with Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. And he's in there theorizing along with, obviously, he's got Piter, his Gola there, his Mantak Gola. Did I just give away that he was a Gola? I think I have. Sorry, spoiler. Spoiler alert. For those that don't know what a Gola is, it's probably not a spoiler yet. So anyway. but just the way they're only a few lines each, but as they feed through, we're getting exposition about the plans within plans, the wheels of motion that are already in place, the ambush that's being placed for the Atreides. But it's done in such a way, too, we get the feelings of not only this robotic creature, Piter de Vries, but we also get, you know, the whole layout. Now, I've got a little bit of a, for those that have got the UK edition, it's not spelled correctly in the novel adaptation that came out here. And that's, I don't know if that's the Golan's version of it that came out. But when that was released, it is pronounced Piter de Vried with a D on the end, not an S. So that must have been, yeah. So I've always been trying to find out off Brian and Kevin and others why that was done in that edition. Because, yeah, that's literally the one that was printed London or whatever. We've got the Piter de Vried. But it's obviously de Vries. So, yeah. So I don't know if that's right or wrong, I'd love to find out one day. Maybe even Frank did it as de Vried. Maybe US readers out there can have a look at their older versions of Dune and let us know.
So, yeah, according to the card game, which I'd love to spend a few minutes talking about.
Oh, let's do it.
The card game, Dune card game, it is de Vried with an S there as well on his card.
There we are. So it's official.
Yep. I think they may have done that, trying to make sure that everything lines up correctly.
I'd say so too. Now, obviously, yeah, games are a huge part of the franchise itself. Obviously, we had the board game back in the day, which has been updated. And, folks, I will spend an entire episode just talking about the game because I love it. I've played it now. It's at least 12 times I've played it now since we got it out. And it actually feels more like a role-playing game than a board game. So we'll talk about that later.
But it certainly does.
Yeah, it does.
I would love to join you on that episode to talk about the board game. I, too, have the Gale Force 9 remake from a couple years ago. But to be honest, they didn't change much because that game from the 1980s was,
gold.
Far ahead of its time.
Oh, big time. And you know, the fact that it's got everything you need to play the game. But as you say, the collectible card game, it looked fantastic as well.
So the collectible card game has one of the most ostentatious attempts at almost mixing together a card game, a board game, and a role-playing game, even for the heady days of the late 1990s when every product under the sun, every licensed character under the sun was getting their own customizable card game because Magic the Gathering was making money hand over fist back then. So everybody was trying to get in on it. There was a Star Wars card game. There was a Star Trek card game. There was a Highlander card game. There was a WWF card game. There was a WCW card game. There was Legend of Five Rings, Samurais and Ninjas card game.
Oh, wow.
There was a Doctor Who card game. I don't have enough time on this episode to name all of the CCGs. There were several Lord of the Rings card games. Anyway, but the Dune card game was so dense and just so many layers of actions within actions that it is notorious. So it won game design awards for being well done, mm-hmm. but it was notorious for having the worst rule book ever, because the person who wrote the first rule book wanted to do it almost in character as someone from the Dune universe at the time when the Atreides were just moving to Arrakis. And so it's like it's like trying to get Princess Irulan to teach you the game. Mm-hmm. You know, she can't stop talking about how great Paul is while she's trying to explain the rules. So it's the best thing to do if you want to play that game, and it can be a really fun game, but first of all, you need more than two players, because much like the Dune story, mm-hmm. it's interesting with all of the players doing their part, all of the different houses and factions, you know. Second of all, you want to make sure you find a copy of the rule book from the expansion set, Thunder at Twilight.
Got it right here.
The Thunder at Twilight rulebook, it is much easier to understand.
Which you can find at, so I just did a Google search, it's at tessera.ru, so tessera.ru, that's what came up when I looked for it. So yep. That's Thunder at Twilight, yep. it's got the full contents there for you as well.
Yes, and so anyway, I'll give a quick summation of how the game works. Each player has two decks, one of cards they're going to keep in their hand, which we call their house deck, and then another separate deck, which is where you have all your famous personalities and holdings of, like, you know, taking over the Shield Wall or taking over the Minor Erg. that is called the Imperial deck. And so during your turn, you have a time where you can go to the Emperor and petition for him to assign someone important, like Duncan Idaho, to your minor house. So the Emperor, if he agrees, and in this case, that's represented by you spending a certain amount of money to pay off Imperial bribes. If the Emperor agrees, he'll assign Duncan to come help your house out for a little while, especially if your house, because you create your own house, but you pick one of the major powers to be aligned with. So like if I'm playing an Atreides aligned deck, I can petition for Duncan to help me, and it'll cost less money for me because Duncan knows that I'm friends with Duke Leto. But influence trading and spending money to bribe officials and all is a very flavorful way of you paying the cost to put a card into play in this game. The other deck, the house deck, has no-name characters like House Swordmaster or House Agent that isn't representing, excuse me, any particular character in Dune, but rather a background character. So like one of the assistants of Shadout Mapes or someone like that, who is working with your own little minor house. But if your major house that you're aligned with is able to accrue 10 spice in their own hoard and 10 influence with the Imperial Court, then you are considered to have won the game because you have won the right for your minor house mm-hmm. to apply for admission to the Landsraad and become a major house. So that is the basic summation of the game. But during the game, you have conflicts with other houses, and sometimes it's intrigue stuff like trying to assassinate someone with a poison tooth or trying to steal spice from their hoard. And sometimes it's way more direct conflict, like sending a battalion of Sardaukar to attack their house.
That's unbelievable, isn't it? That's so good. And the thing is, too, folks, well, you might not be able to find this game out there in the RPG shops. We certainly don't have it here in Australia right now. But if you jump onto now, this is just doing a simple search. You'll be able to find it on ebay.com.au, so the Australian eBay. I can already see literally about 30 entries already of decent CCG stuff you can find on there, all Dune. They've even got the preview copies still there for Eye of the Storm yep. sealed booster packs from 97 as well, buddy.
Yes, yes. And now some of the cards are very expensive. If you have particular awakened versions of Paul Atreides or very rare, secret mission cards, buying a single card can be quite expensive. But if you're just looking for starter decks and some booster packs just to get a feel for it and to appreciate some really beautiful Dune art, most of which is inspired by the Lynch film, but some of it is very much an original interpretation of certain characters.
It's great that that's sort of carried on, isn't it? You know, like we've got June's designs from obviously the David Lynch one that have influenced not only this, but some of the other games and products out there too, particularly the computer games where we had whole cutscenes, you know, basically constructed around what would have been the Lynch movie. You know, we've got quite famous actors in there too, haven't we?
Yeah. I loved in that game, that computer game, where sometimes it was like what you're watching happened right between two scenes in the David Lynch film.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Like, they had the same Atreides outfits. We had, let's just say, somebody from Lord of the Rings, which, you know, I think felt right at home playing, you know, obviously a Mentat. That is, of course, Sulla. From, of course, Indiana Jones as well, the same guy we're talking about here, John Rhys-Davies, who basically gives you a pep talk as you try to defend Eric Keen from the Harkonnen and House Ordos as well. And I loved it because it really set the pace. I think, you know, if Dune had been done in the late 90s like that, he would have been perfect to play Thufa Howard.
And see, just to go back to Hollywood never throws anything away and everybody gets reused eventually, of course, we had the guy who played Peter DeVries was in Lynch's film, showed up as Grimmel Wormtongue in the Lord of the Rings movies that came out at the turn of the century.
Certainly did. And the other thing, too, is that's great about that is that they realized the error of the ways of the weirding module with the sound and the voice, you know, basically being part and parcel of what was the power of the Atreides, and instead used that in artillery pieces and howitzers on the sands of Arrakis instead. So, again, they don't throw away an idea, but they enhance it.
Yep. And that is Brad Dourif is the name of the actor who played DeVries and then later Grimmel Wormtongue. And he was also on Star Trek Voyager, where he once again played a kind of a creepy, almost psychotic character.
He also was in One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's also in Deadwood, played the Doc in that. Actually, quite good. I think that's probably his best role was in that. He was in X-Files as well, played a patient in that. He was also... I personally think, and it's not my favourite Alien movie, but I thought he played a really creepy scientist in it when he brought Ripley back to life as a clone in Alien Resurrection.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That guy really gets around when it comes to genre of films. But if I may just say one more thing about the card game for Dune, if you go to play it with a group of people, probably four people is the best number, which I feel is also probably the best number for the board game, but we'll talk about that on another episode. Be prepared to spend a good part of the first few turns just figuring out the order of phases in the card game. And while it does have a whole lot of 1990s card game mechanics where you tap cards by turning them 90 degrees sideways and you have a bunch of little tokens to represent your Solari and your spice and whatnot, it also has plenty of real world table talk diplomacy, because if you can convince another player to help you out, at least for a partial alliance, you know, you're going to have a much easier time of getting things done in that card game. Because when you petition for people like Duncan Idaho or Baron Harkonnen to join your house for a while, the other players get a chance to try and outbid you by paying off bribes and spending influence in the imperial court to convince the emperor not to let you have Duncan Idaho or what have you.
100% agree.
So, yeah, it has plenty of that intrigue and diplomacy and treaties and whatnot that is all, you know, part and parcel of the Dune universe.
It really does. Now, folks, there is actually quite a few years ago now, there was another Dune game released, and it is one of the most expensive games you can find now because there was only so many copies made, and it was brought out at a convention, and they were going to actually release this at one stage. It is, of course, called Dune Chronicles of the Imperium, and this was a full role-playing game in the same sort of phases of, like, D&D and stuff like that. And I do believe Wizards of the Coast was the one that was going to bring it out at the time. It is now currently going for the Australian cost of 18,246 $1,000.19. So, I mean, that just shows you how much.
Shut the front door. That's one of the most expensive games I've ever heard of. That's ridiculous.
I know, ridiculous. But you might just be able to find a PDF of it somewhere. So you may not need to. Ah. Yeah.
So the game company that made Chronicles of the Imperium was the same one that had made the Dune card game. Because during the 1990s, this company had the license with Brian Herbert. Mm-hmm. It was called Last Unicorn Games.
That's the one, yes.
So Last Unicorn Games got the license to all the Dune novels in 1996. Mm-hmm. And so they started making those games. But then, like you said, Wizards of the Coast, they didn't buy the license from the Herbert estate, but rather they bought part and parcel Last Unicorn Games. They just took it over, you know? And so the reason that the RPG never got released is because Wizards didn't quite have the rights to do all of that stuff.
Oh, big time. You know, and one of the things is too, like, it's having seen the book itself, you know, it was really well thought out. It was very much in that early 2000s/1990s mold of RPG. So definitely has echoes of, even to some degree, like I read it and I'm like, you know, it kind of feels a little bit like the basically Wizards Star Wars that came out, and, which I actually prefer to all the other incarnations. I really enjoyed that round of Star Wars. Before the Saga Edition, I think they did kind of simplify things a bit too much. But
going, so you like that D20 style better than West End Games and their D6 style?
I love West End Games, love playing it, but you know, I think, and we played that for years too. Like that was right through the 90s. That's all we did when we were on school holidays and stuff like that. But when we did, when Wizards came along, we were all just getting into university and we'd played D&D the entire time. So we'd played the original Advanced and Third Edition, which was what we'd pretty much played the whole time through Dark Sun campaigns and stuff like that.
So, oh, yeah, Dark Sun. I love it.
Love it. And Planescape, that's the other one we did as well heavily. Like we get into science class and, you know, if the teacher or the professor we had at the time was having malfunctioning equipment and stuff like that, we'd just turn our chairs and tables around, slam them together and get the dice out. And we'd just be literally doing Planescape. He goes, Mr. O'Brien, are you ready to return to the class? I said, no, I'm too busy taking out a troll, sir, but I'll be with you soon, okay? And for some reason, every time he did that, I got a critical. So it was pretty damn cool. We're rolling that 20.
That's epic. That's amazing.
It's so good.
Well, hey, you know, it's great that you talk about Dark Sun on a Dune podcast, because clearly the world of Dark Sun was influenced by Dune.
Oh, big time.
Right down to the fact that the planet that the original Dark Sun campaign was set upon sounds very much like Arrakis, that the Atthis.
Big time.
And so forth.
It really does. And I think one of the things, too, about the D&D world, you know, like fantasy is always my second love. It's not my first, but there's something about the archetypes of those characters that we have, whether it's in the RPGs, the books, or even just in movies like Conan the Barbarian and stuff like that. There's such archetypal heroes, villains, and mischievous people that you really get a sense of their world fast just through their eyes. And I think that's... it's got more to do with Dune than it has science fiction and goes to do with Dune. I think there's more fairy tale in places like Star Wars, whereas when you look at Dune, there's a much closer tie to fantasy, I think, in characters.
Certainly. And now, you know, part of our mandate here at the Mullet Guild is to help people who are new to the Dune universe to sort of get acclimated. Almost, I view this, your first two episodes, definitely, but I think the whole spirit of the show is really, at this point in time, helping people get ready for the new movie coming in December of this year, because I think it's going to be huge. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the best ways to describe Dune to a newcomer, but a newcomer who is a fan of genre fantasy, whether it be science fiction, space fantasy, or space opera, you know, is that Dune is like a mixture between Dungeons and Dragons and Star Trek, because you have the galaxy-spanning civilizations of Star Trek, but you have the quasi-religious and overtly religious overtones and belief in higher powers and almost, you know... acts of God that you do in things like Dungeons and Dragons. And it is also, to my mind, a good way to introduce somebody. If you find out that the person you're talking to is a fan of Games Workshop at all, and their Warhammer 40,000 universe, that is a very easy sidestep into the world of Dune, because like we said, Dune has influenced so many modern gaming and genre conventions, that when you look at Warhammer 40,000, that's almost like Dune's dark cousin, you know?
Oh, it is. And the thing is, like, you can go right up to the Space Marines themselves, and there's a real Sardaukar feel to them, you know, like the, and even the Atreides troops themselves, you know, the Atreides army. And I think that's the thing, is it really is about that. It is more a case of, if you guys want to look at it, people coming into it and from non-sci-fi, from non-games, this has got close to the Napoleonic era as far as, you know, the armies and how they're sort of presented.
Yes.
You know, in much larger format. One of the things that was asked of me is, why are they using swords? Why are they using knives? Why are they using, aren't they using blasters like in Star Wars? So this question was pretty much raised a long time ago by our dear co-founder, Kev. He goes, hey, man, why aren't they using blasters, man? Well, they are using aren't using blasters. What they call laser guns is what they've got in that universe. But everybody's got a body shield. So it's a belt which protrudes as a shield around the body, which can basically stop most generic blaster, projectile, and, of course, knife and saber strikes. However, a slower blade, so a kindle, which is a knife or a sword, can go through that shield at a slower velocity. So hence why now these days the convention is, or the great convention as they call it in Dune, is that everything's reduced to personal combat. So one-on-one, mano-a-mano, Renaissance-style sword play. Because of that reason. So it's very much a chess game. It's not about too much like a hack and slash, because it's just going to bounce off the shields. But part of that too is, if you shoot a laser gun into one of these Holtzman-generated shields, it has an atomic effect.
Yes, and I love that this is a perfect example of Frank Herbert taking the technology and using it to illustrate a philosophical point. Mm-hmm. And it also demonstrates Dune's slight samurai and Asian philosophical influence here as well, because the personal shield is the perfect example of a very Asian martial arts inspired philosophy when it comes to combat, but also when it comes to life itself. Because if you look at the shield, like you were saying, Adam, if you shoot it with a projectile weapon, or you throw a shuriken at the personal shield, or you come charging in with something akin to a katana, it will deflect, because the personal shield takes your own kinetic energy and turns it back against you, which is like Bruce Lee taught us in Kung Fu and Jeet Kune Do. You use the enemy's strength against him. You be like water. You know, you adjust and you move and you just keep changing and flowing. And so if the enemy comes at you with this huge strike, you're going to sidestep and shift your weight and judo toss him over, because you take his own momentum and you use it against him. And so the personal shield is the perfect physical, technological embodiment of that philosophy that Herbert was weaving into Dune as a society and as a book. And then you see that that idea where you can come at them with the slower blade. A meticulous and well-thought-out assault is way more efficient than a direct, brutal assault.
Oh, 100%. Now, one of the big ones is also the fact that this universe obviously has, you know, a lot of that technology that you're going to find. You know, it's obviously something that, you know, all universes have travel, you know, within stars and stuff like that. In this universe, it's there. But the big thing is how to get there. And the big thing that changes is the Spacing Guild. So I was asked a question by a listener, how does it work? Is it like Star Wars? Do they just hit light speed? Well, no, they don't. They actually pick points between two systems or wherever they're going, and it's the spice that actually helps the navigator inside, which is human, mutated by the spice, to actually safely plot a distance, and then the actual ship does all the work.
So, right.
Yeah. So it's a little bit different than what you... I think even in the movies, it was or even in the miniseries, it's not really brought about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think they didn't. They just didn't have enough time, if you will, to get deeper into how does the FTL, the faster than light travel, work in the Dune universe. And, you know, the short answer is the navigators move you by the power of their mind, which they did talk about folding space, which is an interesting way of incorporating some very contemporary at the time and even today astrophysics idea. Okay, yeah. So what I was saying was the faster-than-light technology is much more in keeping with contemporary astrophysics ideas at that time that Herbert was writing the novel, and then later in the movies, where you collapse the amount of space in front of the vessel so that the space behind the vessel sort of propels you forward, almost like you're coasting on an ocean wave, instead of actual engine power, you know.
I agree. And I think one of the things is, too, is that, you know, when I read this, I definitely didn't picture it like it is in Star Trek, Star Wars, or even Farscape. I almost, the way Frank describes it is that it literally just, the space around it disappears, and then, you know, they go from Caladan space to Arrakis. And it's almost like it's just in one place and then moves instantaneously, which I think... In my mind, it was just like it was almost like TARDIS, I suppose. You know how the TARDIS just sort of...
Yes. Yeah, the TARDIS just sort of materializes somewhere new.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting. Now, one of the other ones I was going to do is that every episode, I'm going to pick a certain character and kind of describe outside of Dune what that character's like. The one I decided today is one we looked at last week, but I think I want to get your take on this character as well. So we'll talk about him again. And that is, of course... Duncan Idaho, who I personally think is the closest to Connor McLeod we've got in this series.
Yeah, that's an excellent description of Duncan. And I just love how he's so heroic in the novel. And yet Paul learns so much from him about swordplay and what have you. But then eventually we see how Paul surpasses the master, in this case, Duncan. You know, Paul becomes way more than his teacher, all of his teachers, but in the case of Duncan, he becomes more of him when it moves past him when it comes to the knife duel with Fade. And I think that it's just a perfect example of the idea of mentor and mentee and how that was changing during the tumultuous time of the 1960s when Herbert was writing this book.
That's right. And I was kind of waiting in Dune Messiah when I finally read it. I was a late reader of the Messiah book, probably in the, I think it was the early 2000s I picked that up. So I'd already read the original novel. And all of a sudden, Hate turns up. And I'm like, okay, so this is a spoiler, folks. So if you haven't read Dune Messiah, you might want to tread lightly here. So Hate turns up. And Paul goes, oh, Duncan, g'day, mate, how you going? And, of course, this is, of course, what we call a Gola, which is a clone that's born from the dead flesh or parts of the flesh of the original host or the original living person. And through the flesh, memories or basically the actual, you know, not the soul but the memory of that person that has passed can be regenerated and triggered to come back. So in certain ways, Duncan's back, which would kind of make him immortal, would it not? Which means I am Duncan Idaho of the Clan Idaho, and I am there immortal. There you go.
Yeah, I can see it. And I guess further spoilers, you know, on down the line in the novel series, there's a time when somebody decides to do that process with Lady Jessica herself and Paul as well. So, you know, it gets a little wonky further down the line in the books, but that's an excellent interpretation of Duncan's arc when he comes up as the Ghoul.
That's right, and he's also a Swordmaster of Ginaz, which we don't really get a sense of in Frank's six books, but now that we've got the prequel era, so particularly the prelude to Dune, so the first three books, House Atreides, House Harkonnen, and House Carino, Kevin and Brian go through and basically show... not only Gurney's path, because you've got to remember Gurney and also Duncan come from Geaty Prime. So the baby in the slave pits of the Harkonnen, the hunting grounds for particularly for Duncan. So he comes from a pretty harsh upbringing. Like, he loses everybody in his family there. And then eventually, you know, he gets picked up by the Duke, and basically the Duke brings him up and says, right, well, if you're going to be, you know, this person, I need you to be trained. So he sends him off to Ginaz to be trained. Who are the Swordmasters? The Swordmasters are kind of, I suppose, in some ways, very much like the Immortals themselves. They are masters of not just one school of thought when it comes to martial arts, swordplay. They pretty much have to master everything, which makes them pretty elusive.
Yeah, and they are very reminiscent, a contemporary character in the 60s and 70s, of the weapon masters in the old Flash Gordon serials, the ones that build weapons for Ming the Merciless, and then eventually Flash and all of his friends go over there to try and convince the weapon masters to help them overthrow Ming. And the weapon masters, you know, they want nothing of it, but they do respect Flash and his men once they prove they are masters of various weapons on that planet. So they make some gadgets for them. They won't directly attack Ming, but they will train Flash and his allies in using the gear that they built for them. And then, of course, later in the Defenders of the Earth animation series, we see Ming's son goes to the Weapon Masters to get a present for himself when he's about to have his wedding, where he marries the Phantom's daughter. But anyway, but speaking of the Swordmasters in Dune, yes, Duncan's path that leads him to that area is very much reminiscent of, also, in addition to Highlander, Conan the Barbarian. Because Conan loses all of his family and his tribe and what have you, and then comes back later having mastered various forms of combat and weaponry. Only much like Duncan Idaho in Dune, Conan comes to realize that all of that martial skill isn't necessarily the only thing that he needs to help him overcome that dark past, you know.
It really is. And, you know, the other thing, too, is you got to see his point. He's sort of like I suppose in the first book in particular, he's kind of like the recon party. You know, he's got to go out and meet the Fremen and basically become friends with Stilgar. And they do get into an ambush where he actually helps one of the Fremen get to safety, and in that way actually saves Stilgar's brother, I think, if I remember right. You know, it's a great part of the book because you get to see Duncan's character. He's a hero. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, he is the quintessential original hero in the Dune saga. And then what happens with Paul is he realizes that in order for him to truly save the universe, he is going to have to pass beyond the traditional idea of a hero. Because we could have had an amazing story and a very traditional one with Duncan Idaho befriending the Fremen, you know, and bringing the noble savages, as it were, with him to overthrow the Baron on Dune and liberate the planet and, you know, do all that stuff. And it would have been a perfect, normal, almost trope-ridden sci-fi messiah story. But Herbert's original book takes it way beyond all that, because Paul does more than just liberate the noble savages. He even does more than just overthrow the emperor and his corrupt regime.
Oh, definitely. And I think one of the things, too, is some of the way that some of those scenes we see in not so much Richard Jordan's portrayal. I think there's not enough of Richard Jordan's in there to really carry the character. I think, you know, we didn't get a sense of him in the 1984 film. But, however, in the sci-fi adaptation, particularly the first one, I really think we get a sense of who he is. He's this sort of suave but also very tough and cool character who everyone trusts and is Duke Leto's right-hand man. As much as the other teachers of Paul are, he has 110% trust in what Duncan can do. And we get to see that with how he's kind of, I think, probably the closest thing to a friend that Paul has when they get to Arrakis. And, you know, he's in the Arrakeen Temple, and he's, you know, like, they're straight up saying, like, you know, oh, wow, Duncan, you're here. You know, like, you can see that these guys obviously have a bit more of a friendship than just a mentorship there. But also the fact that when we do see Stilgar turn up, and I still think to this day this is the best portrayal of Stilgar as the one in the original sci-fi miniseries. There's just something about how, first of all, respectful he is. He doesn't, there's no break of character when it comes to, he's not mad, he's never happy or sad or anything like that. He's just straight. He is the Naib of the tribe. As a Naib, he'll always be the machine that keeps moving.
Yeah, yeah. He is like the desert itself, constantly churning, whirling sandstorm, you know. And you just never... You can always depend on Stilgar to do the things that he does. He's just a constant. He's like a universal bedrock.
He really is, you know, and it's the ground there that really comes through. One of the things too is, you know, for all of you out there that are new to Dune, what is the story like of that first, well, of the movie, you know, what is it like? Well, I'll tell you in a heart, you know, it is really, at its heart, Lawrence of Arabia. That's what it really is. You know, it is literally, you know, T.E. Lawrence has everything crushed and grind around him. Everything falls apart. Probably more emotionally and spiritually for him being in the British Army at the time, which really, you know, in some ways echoes the Atreides and the Atreides Army when they go to the desert of Arrakis. And then he literally goes native, and it's Stilgar and other, like those in the Fremen, that break about Paul's training and show him those ways. But obviously T. Lawrence goes out and he meets the Arabian people and, you know, learns their ways, becomes stronger for it. And then when he comes back, people don't know who he is, but he's this sort of phantom of the desert, if you like, which is exactly what happens to the Harkonnen when Muad'Dib comes. Wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. I think the Lawrence of Arabia comparison is perfect. And just like that story, this story also tries to teach us an important lesson about not taking a particular culture for granted and not discounting any particular culture.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, obviously, folks, in future episodes, we're going to be looking at different facets of this franchise. We looked at the collectible card game today. And definitely, folks out there, if you're listening today to the show, send in some questions, whether it's to the Lethal Mullet podcast page there, where we'll have links to the episode. You can leave some questions in the comments there when this is shared. But you can also email into phantompodcastnetwork@gmail.com, where we'll definitely go through and talk about anything that you guys bring up. One of the big ones, I think, is we're going to look at the computer games very, very soon. And I'll give you this little bit of info. Vanessa Marshall is in the first game that went out with cutscenes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a great game, very well made at the time. Much like all the Dune property games, it was ahead of its time in that it was introducing particular new concepts. So that'll be a fun episode.
Oh, without a doubt. And we'd love to see you, Scotty, on episode in the next couple of weeks. Maybe looking at a different area of Dune. Maybe we could look at something like the Butlerian Jihad. Where did this all start, you know?
Yeah, yeah. We got to talk about the machine wars and artificial intelligence and how that influenced Dune to be the kind of very rote and ritualistic society that it is when we first encounter it at the beginning of Paul Atreides' story.
Without a doubt. And we can kind of, I suppose, talk about how James Cameron sat there in Canada and he read the book and went, you know, I got an idea for a robot movie. Oh, yeah. You never know.
Yes, totally.
All right, before we wrap, where can folks find you on the web, my friend?
So if you want to follow me online, my social medias are my regular name on Facebook, Scott Baltman. You can find me on Twitter at ScotticusMax. And unsurprisingly, since I've been doing all this literary commentary on this episode, I do write my own science fiction novels. And you can check out my author website at writegreatscott.com.
Awesome. So folks, go and check it out. And also you can find me at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can check this show and all the others, including, of course, What a Piece of Junk a Star Wars podcast, all at Phantom Podcast Network on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. Go and check it out there and enjoy all the great episodes of shows in there too. And make sure you check out Dune at your local bookstore or go and check it out online. Get the audiobook. The audiobook is fantastic. The work done on that, with multiple cast members on it. The only feedback I will give to the guys that did the audiobook, there's large chunks where it's just the narrator pretty much, whereas it could have been a mixture of that plus all of the cast, because he's got people as, you know, Lady Jessica, as the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. I know it's a big book, but it could have been done, folks. You know, it could have been all done. So you do get snippets of dialogue where they're all together. But for anyone new to Dune, definitely check that out. It is a must. But from us here, and of course, Phantom Podcast Network's The Molecule, I bid you adieu, and we'll see you very, very soon. And a big thanks to Scott. Thank you so much for being on tonight, my friend.
Oh, I had a great time, but yeah, we got to jump in the ornithopter. We got worm sign, like, everywhere. Worm sign, dude.
Oh, I can feel the thumping. Oh, my God. The rhythm's coming. Shai Halud is on the way. We hope you've enjoyed The Mullet Guild, brought to you by Phantom Podcast Network's The Little Mullet Podcast. And, of course, thanks to the one, the only, Scott Bowman for joining us. And do check out his podcast and much, much more at the Phantom Podcast Network at fbnet.podbean.com. Folks, we'll catch you next time. We've got worm sign. So we're going to ride this worm all the way back to home. We'll see you later.